The Kevin O'Connor Show is coming up next. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Today we get a good one with my guest Tom Haberstroh with 10 things we're thankful for so far this NBA season. If you're listening to this show in the United States, wishing you a very, very happy Thanksgiving. We recorded this show earlier in the week, so if anything crazy happened over the course of the week on Monday or Tuesday's or Wednesday's games, maybe I'll record something that you'll hear at the end of the show. But for now, here's my conversation with Tom Haberstroh with 10 things we're thankful for so far this NBA season. Bring us on in, Father John Misty. Happy Thanksgiving, Tom Haberstroh. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show.
Hey, I am very thankful to be on with you. I'm pumped and jacked and very thankful on this Thanksgiving week.
We're going to be talking about 10 things we're thankful for this NBA season. You want to get us started, Tom?
I can do it. Yeah, let's get things started. On Thanksgiving week, we've got a buffet of things that we're excited about. What's a good appetizer? Like, I guess it would be like... I don't know. It's not mashed potatoes. It's more of a side. But if we're going to go with an appetizer to set the table, I think we're going to go big here. I'm going to go, the number one thing that I'm thankful for this Thanksgiving is the Golden Guys. Kevin, the Golden Guys of the NBA. We had the Golden Girls.
We're overlapping already. Sometimes the sides are better than the main course. Continue, Tom.
Yes. The mashed potatoes with a little butter and gravy. Maybe that's what this is right here. The golden brown mashed potatoes. So we have the Golden Girls, right? We have the Golden Bachelor. We have the Golden Guys in the NBA. This is Stephen Curry, Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Chris Paul. I'm even throwing James Harden, DeMar DeRozan in that group because of this stat here for you. KOC, did you know that we have five players in today's NBA that are averaging over 20 points per game at 35 or older? In the previous two decades, we never had multiple 35 plus averaging 20 points per game in any season for the past two decades until last year. There were three of them. Now there's five. And so we got James Harden, DeMar DeRozan, Steph Curry, KD, LeBron James. So we have five of them. That's an NBA history high. We've never had this many scorers this old in the NBA. And I think we need to be grateful for it because on one level, it's awesome to see them, the players that we grew up with, Kevin, watching Kevin Durant, LeBron James, Steph Curry, still playing at an elite level in the NBA. But I also think it's setting the bar for the next generation of players to really give a flying whatever about their bodies and about maintaining this longevity. I think it's not just good for them to be, you know, at this level. I think it's also a great bar, a goal, something to strive for the Anthony Edwards, the Luka Doncic's, the Victor Wembanyama's, that like, yo, these guys, they were playing for 20 years at a high level. I want that to continue. And so I'm thankful for the Golden Guys in today's NBA.
I had very similar to you, Tom, to add on to your last point about how it raises the bar. There are 11 players this season, 35 years or older, playing 25 plus minutes per game. KD, DeMar DeRozan, LeBron James, James Harden, Brooke Lopez, Jimmy Butler, Steph, Chris Paul, Horford, Conley, and Westbrook. So it's the big name, the golden age players. You're talking about those future Hall of Famers that are still playing at a high level, but it's also the role players. Guys like Brooke Lopez, evolving, extending his career, becoming a high-level defender, becoming a three-point shooter. It's Russell Westbrook finding a home in Denver. He's going through adversity with these teams where he's failed to transition into a role player. Here he is now in Denver working. Mike Conley, Minnesota, becomes a high-volume three-point shooter after years as a lead point guard. And Al Horford, of course, in Boston, wins a championship. He epitomizes the meaning of growing and extending your range and evolving as a player. These guys, the role players as well, do raise the bar and show, hey, here's how you adapt to the times. Here's how you accept a lesser role in the name of winning. So I'm very thankful for these older guys in today's NBA with everybody that we have. It's the stars. It's the role players. It's been a lot of great players that we've enjoyed watching for many years.
Yeah, and I think you're right. It's not just the scorers, DeMar and James Harden. It's the role players, like you said. I'm wondering, KOC, what do you think's behind it? Like, we've never seen a golden age like this where players are playing into their 40s. LeBron is one of one, of course, but playing at this level, this well, I mean, it really, really makes you think about whether it's the training, whether it's how attentive they are to the way, you know, they eat, they sleep, all of that that goes into making sure you're still on the road and still, you know, this classic car that can still bring it every single night. It does mean that you have to be way more attentive to the details, the small stuff in your life, in order to be playing at this high of a level. I'm pretty sure the 11 that you named, pretty sure that's got to be a record too, is just guys playing 25 minutes or more all at this age. It seems like we are at this point where players are going deeper in their careers, maybe not on average, but there is a select group of players that if you are a multi all-star player, you can look at the next 20 years and say like, hey, I can actually do this for 15, 16 seasons.
100%. I think it's what's gone into it is a lot of the things that you said. I think sports science is at a level where some of these guys who invest money into their bodies, like what was the number for LeBron? $1 million a year into his body. It might be more than that. I'd imagine other
way
players
more now,
invest.
Yeah,
exactly. I'd imagine other players invest near $1 million per year, or at least high six figures into their bodies. And I think that's it. And I think also it could have to do with in terms of skill training too. Guys like Al Horford who improved their three-point shot, or Brooke Lopez, the attention to detail, the investment. I don't think, like a lot of times people assume players stop getting better at age 28. But DeMar DeRozan has become such a better playmaker and passer in his late 20s into his 30s. It really shifted his final year in Toronto, which feels like forever ago at this point, but it continued when he was with San Antonio. He became more of a point guard instead of just as a scorer. So I think guys are continuing to get better as well. So perhaps there's some emphasis on skills training as well, deeper into your 30s. But it's a lot of different factors, man. It's a lot of different factors, but either way, no matter what's gone into it, I am incredibly, incredibly thankful to still have these guys in the league today. Another thing I'm thankful for, Tom, is honesty with the media. And I'm specifically referencing Mikal Bridges. He said a weird quote after the Knicks lost to the Jazz the other night. He said, "It's easy when you're making shots to play defense, so we just got to find a way when we're missing." Now, they gave up 121 to the Jazz. That's what they did before he said this. The Knicks had a bottom 10 defensive rating this season. And Bridges saying this made me think, wait a minute. Is this why he's not the same guy on defense this year? He's not fighting through ball screens the way we've seen him do before. He's not playing with that dog in him on defense like we've seen him do with his prime in the Suns and even with the Nets. And him saying this is an admission that it's his shooting that's causing this. He's at 30% from three, 64% from the line. He's shooting the hell out of it from mid-range, over 60%. He's shooting the hell out of it from the corners. But from above the break, he's below 20% from three. Is he in his own head on defense because he's missing shots? So that's why I'm thankful for his honesty with the media, because I think it gives a real glimpse into one of the main storylines, I think, in New York this year. They were top 10 in defense last season, Tom. And it's not just Karl Anthony Towns with the bad at-rim defense. It's Mikal Bridges and others on the perimeter with New York's defense. So I'm thankful for honesty.
I love that. I love that honesty. And I love we talked about it, you know, the self-deprecation of being able to look at yourself and be honest about what you see in the mirror. And for him, a lot of this is, man, I'm not shooting well. And it's hard to play defense when you're, you know, thinking about your shot or your shot's not falling and you're not getting that kind of positive dopamine hit of getting that, I don't know, the shot, seeing the ball going through the net. Maybe that's part of it. I also think this might be part of it. He's averaging a league high 38 minutes per game. This is Tibbs. This is what we worried about with Tibbs going to play for Tibbs, is that he's going to be run into the ground, and that playing streak that he hasn't missed a game. He's the Iron Man of the NBA. He's not missed a game in his NBA career. Not since, I think, high school has he missed a game. And it was going to be tested with Thibodeau. And now he's playing 4 more minutes a game than he did last year, a career high 38 minutes per game. So my thing is, some of this might be mental, but how much of it is like a derivative of the fatigue, or maybe just him getting acclimated into the Thibodeau New York cauldron, right? The crucible of that environment. Maybe that's playing a role into it too. Cause I do think that he's shooting 25% from 3 and 4th quarters. Like, there's not nothing there.
Tired legs. Could be tired legs for Bridges. And one of the guys that I think Tibbs needs to play more is Jericho Sims. He's playing under 15 minutes per game, but he really has been their second best defender behind OG Anunoby, who has been spectacular individually, but OG can't do it all on his own. But we have not yet seen a lineup with Karl Anthony Towns at the 4 and Jericho Sims at the 5. I just don't understand why Tibbs has not played that lineup yet this season, when Sims is holding guys at about 40% when defending shots within 6 feet of the rim. He's been great rim protection. He's been really effective as a perimeter guy as well when he's been in switch situations. So I just don't understand how Tibbs can have seen Cat's success playing next to Rudy Gobert last season in Minnesota, and then see him allowing 73% on shots within 6 feet of the rim this season, the worst mark for any big in the NBA, the third worst mark in the NBA, period. The worst is Keontae George, a small guard. The second worst is Jordan Hawkins, a 2 guard. And Karl Anthony Towns at 73.1% is the third worst overall, the worst of all bigs. How can he see the way that defense is performing this season and not say, let's try out Sims at the 5 and Cat at the 4 for a few minutes, and let's maybe decrease the minutes for some of my hardworking wings out there and see how it affects their individual defense as well? It's just baffling to me, Tom.
Well, isn't that kind of related? Is maybe Tibbs is like, I got to play Mikal so many minutes, or my wing guys so many minutes, to make up for that lack of rim protection that we have. And so maybe the solution is to get, whether it's Sims or someone else, figure out a way.
Try it.
Yep.
Come on.
And that's what playoffs are all about, is having the flexibility to adapt series by series, matchup by matchup. And if you have no games in the regular season of experience of Cat playing at the 4, that might be a problem come May, when you're trying to win a championship and they decide to throw a new action at you and your players are like, we have never played like this before. And so I do think the regular season is very much a lab, an experimentation place for the postseason. And that's why, above all else, maybe if the results aren't there, at least they have the experience of going to those different looks. A guy that I know Tom Thibodeau has a lot of admiration for is number 2 on my list of things I'm thankful for. Okay. Hubie Brown.
Ooh, good one.
Hubie Brown, 91 years old. The report recently was that he's hanging it up after this season, his final year as a broadcaster for the NBA at ESPN. And I gotta say, this is insane that he's still doing this, that he's still a commentator at 91 years old, speaking in the second person. Yeah, if you're Karl Towns out on this play, you gotta, we know Hubie Brown is an elite broadcaster, but maybe people don't realize how he's doing this at this age. We need to give him his flowers. 91 years old. Do you know, Kevin, what was happening in the world when he was born in 1933? I'm going to give you a couple facts here. We're going to go all history buff on you and take a little time travel to 1933, the year that Hubie Brown was born, okay? Number 1, stereo records were invented, Kevin.
Wow.
Okay? We didn't have stereo records or any stereo audio for music until 1933, the year he was born. Okay. He also was raised for the first few years of his life without a telephone. This guy didn't have a telephone. Not talking about cell phones for you kids out there. I'm talking just a straight up telephone for much of his childhood. He didn't have a car or a telephone in the house. 1933. Number 2, he had He was born in a year in which they started constructing the Golden Gate Bridge. Okay, it didn't exist. The Golden Gate Bridge didn't exist until 1933, or the idea of it didn't start getting constructed until 1933. Prohibition was still in effect in 1933. The FM radio was invented in 1933. Hubie Brown, wow. 91 years old. He's been doing it so long that people didn't know what a telephone was or didn't have a telephone when he was born. So shout out to Hubie Brown. I'm giving you flowers. It's amazing that he has been doing this through age 90. Congratulations on your final season. And yeah, Hubie Brown. It's amazing.
It's a great one. Hubie Brown, total legend, man. He's incredible. Still very good to this day. Even in his 90s, still a good broadcaster. It's not like he's totally washed.
He brings it.
He's still good. He's got energy and enthusiasm still to this day. Good for him.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we get to what we're thankful for next, we'll be back after a break. Next up on my list, not as sentimental as Hubie Brown, I'm thankful for Chris Dunn. I'm thankful for Chris Dunn because here's a guy, sixth team in 9 years, and he played only 40 games during the 2021 and 22 seasons. Dealt with a bunch of injuries those years. And then last year with Utah, played 66 games. He's played every game with the Clippers this season, and he has been absolutely awesome. He has been incredible to watch. He's defended SGA and Fox and Curry and KD and Franz Wagner and Lauri Markkanen, and they get him defending big guys, small, quick guys. He's been a screener for James Harden, rolling to the basket, passing out of the short roll. He's hitting almost 40% of his threes. He's been just constantly active off ball. Like, you know how we talked last week about what makes Stephen Curry so effective on offense is the constant motion on the offensive end of the floor, how he's always moving, always a threat. Chris Dunn always feels like he's moving on defense as well. He's always active, always aware. There was a play against the Kings when he was defending Fox off ball. And one of the things with Intuit Dome, even though it's not a hockey arena, I feel like there's wet spots. Like, I saw a lot of guys slipping around when I was at a game there recently. And I saw Chris Dunn slip on a play underneath the basket when he was defending Fox. But as he was getting up, the ball was an entry pass was being thrown to Sabonis around the elbow. And as he's getting up, he has the awareness to fly towards Sabonis, poke the ball away, jump start a transition opportunity for the Clippers, and they scored on the break. And it's just like, this dude is constantly locked in, no matter the situation. And I admire that about Chris Dunn, one of the premier role players in the NBA after fighting through injuries and adversity for multiple years in a row. Good for him.
Another Tibbs guy. He was the number five overall pick for the Minnesota Timberwolves when Tibbs was, I don't know, I guess running president of basketball operations and being the head coach in Minnesota. But he's a great example, Kev. It was out of left field for sure. When you said his name, I was like, wow, this is a deep cut. But an incredible story. A guy who was a number five overall pick, averaged 3 points a game his rookie season for Minnesota, and then basically washed out of the NBA. And now he's basically built himself a 10-year career in the league. And it goes for anybody, any player in the league. Even if you are a top five pick in the NBA draft, there is a lot of guys who don't make it. And even smaller number of guys who pulled off Chris Dunn, rejuvenating his career, you know, revived from the scraps or the ashes, and basically turned into a very usable player, you know, a decade later after he was having one of the roughest rookie seasons I can remember from a top five pick. So a great story and a great example of someone who can be a lesson to the other guys who might be struggling first couple years in the league, even if you come in with a lot of hype. You know, I don't know where you were on the Chris Dunn draft profile back then, but I do think that, like, there are a lot of guys, top five picks, top one picks, that look at this and say, maybe this NBA isn't for me and maybe I don't have it. Chris Dunn certainly had those moments and he turned that adversity into an opportunity and is now doing great things. All right, Kev, my third thing.
Tom.
This is controversial. I am thankful for the dunk score.
Oh, dude, I did not have this on my list, but I was thinking about putting it on. The dunk score is very cool.
Very cool. Okay.
Explain it. A lot of listeners have no idea what it is.
The dunk score is this new metric from the NBA where they are creating a metric based on like 13 different variables of inputs that are creating a dunk score, like a their own version of the 10 judgment score at dunk contest. They're creating their own dunk metric. And what's cool about this, I'm not really so into the idea of quantifying art in this way, is like quantifying how good of a dunk was that. It's very, I don't know, it's a tall task, no pun intended, to quantify something that is so subjective in what makes a great dunk. But the thing that I'm so excited about is they're publishing on NBA.com the underlying statistics that go into this dunk score. And that to me is really exciting as an analyst and a researcher. I nerd out on this stuff. They have like 10 different categories they're publishing on NBA.com, including the ball speed, the ball height, the vertical, like the how high a player got off the ground on the dunk, whether it was a two-handed dunk, a left-handed dunk, a right-handed dunk. They're also, whether it's a lob, they have some subjective things like style and stuff. And I don't know how exactly they're going about doing that. Cause I did see like Bam Adebayo had like the style points was like the lowest of all the dunks this season. I watched him. It was actually a pretty cool dunk. So I don't know exactly what they're doing there, but I did look at a lot of these inputs like vert. It's kind of fun. Like Shaedon Sharpe has the highest average vert in the NBA on his dunks. That's something we didn't have before. But I'm very thankful for the Hawkeye technology, the camera tracking, the player tracking cameras that they have now, kind of like the same VAR system that they have in soccer or in tennis to decide whether the ball was in or out. That same company is now doing a lot of the next level metrics that we're seeing in the NBA. And I'm very thankful for it because now we know on the average dunk for Nikola Jokic, it's 18.2 inches of vert height, which is tied for the lowest in the NBA. So not that we needed it to confirm what our eyes are telling us. It's just still fun to know that Jokic, his average vert on dunks is 18 inches, which is just about the lowest in the NBA.
I think it's awesome. I agree with your point. It's a tough challenge and sometimes not worth it to try to quantify art. And that's what dunking is. But the list does a pretty good job. Like when I first clicked into it, I was like, best dunk of the season. Maybe Christian Brown dunking on Rudy Gobert. And I see that's ranked fourth highest dunk score behind a Brandon Miller dunk, a Jalen Green dunk, and number one, John Collins poster against the Bulls. And I think it does a pretty good job. Like if you watch through them, they're all, it factors in the defensive player, how much he looks like he contested the shot, how close he was. I think it probably factors in the defender's contact, I believe that stat was, something like that, like contact made with the defender. It's a lot of different stats for every single individual dunk. And that Christian Brown dunk ranking fourth, pretty good, pretty good. And like you said, Tom, it has every single dunk in there. The lower end dunks all look like they deserve the lower end scores. I'm impressed by the stat. I'm really impressed by the stat. And it makes me wonder, what could they do for other actions in the NBA? Could they do this for the most miraculous three-pointers? Like, what about the LaMelo shot that he hit the other night? We're making the announcer completely freak out. Or it's like this weird turnaround, one-footed three-pointer. Could they do it for threes? Movement? Action, how close the defender is, what else could they do it for? Because it's pretty good for the dunks.
I also think like what you're describing, where else can this fit in? Is like where can we use this technology? In baseball, we have all of these, you know, StatCast, the exit velo, the spin rate on a pitch. And some people I think there is a paralysis by analysis at some point we need to just let the game speak for itself. But there are elements of the game where I feel like it's cool to know how hard that hit was, or what is the probability of that becoming a hit, and what a great play by that fielder. Because normally that play gets through the middle 99% of the time based on the underlying metrics. And what a play. We can like celebrate great plays and great, you know, catches, et cetera. In the same way in basketball, you could think about like, the score probability on a dunk. You could rank the best blocks of the year based on the score probability, and you could have, you know, not just your eyeball test of like, hey, I remember this great block earlier. You can actually go into the data and say like, this play had a 99.7% chance of going in, and here comes Jared Allen with this great block. And we might not have seen it. It might not have been an amazing play on just your eyeball test, but then when you look at it, a second look, or when the numbers are saying it, you're like, oh, that's right. He covered 30 feet of ground in a half a second to make that block. And I think that's where we're going to go is, you know, your vert on your jump shot, like LaMelo Ball, Karl Anthony Towns, they don't jump on their jump shot. And I think that's, we're going to see some of those metrics for, you know, jump shooters. Who gets the Ray Allen lift off the ground the most? I'm thinking guys like Eddie House or Zach LaVine, some guys who just get so high on their jumpers that is going to be another element of the game that we're going to quantify. Passes, the speed of the pass, the distance of a bounce pass. Like imagine if we had
the accuracy, the longest, like a strike zone, like who makes the most accurate passes into the shooter's pocket.
Exactly. Like that would be, I think LeBron James is famous for this, is just the accuracy of his passes right in the pocket of the shooter is a lot of ways the reason why he's so good, and why he's as Kirk Goldsberry points out, he's assisted more three-pointers or created more three-pointers than anybody in NBA history. And a lot of that is because he always hits that strike zone on the pass. So I'm thankful for Hawkeye. I'm thankful for that. And the potential for refereeing is leaving a lot of the subjective calls away from the referees, and we're going to have an opportunity to take some of those calls away from the officials so they can put they can focus more energy on other things rather than whether that was a goaltend. Because honestly, it's mind-boggling that we don't have goaltending already automated at this point. It happens every game, and the fact that that's still an eye test thing. I know that they're working on this, getting Hawkeye, you know, to automate things like goaltends, but all that, I'm just very thankful for something like Hawkeye.
I wish I could be thankful for more automation in terms of the officiating. I wish I could be. I wish we were there already, Tom. Why are we standing in front of a screen for 5 minutes in the final minute of a game sometimes? Just say, let's quicken things up. Let's speed it up. Come on.
Yeah, we had a great moment, Kevin Calabro and Lamar Hurd on the broadcast the other night when it was one of the more exciting finishes of the year, and we just had to sit in front of a camera and watch, you know, the referees stand around at half court, and it's like, let's... We got to figure out a way to fix this. Got to figure out a way.
Come on.
What's next on your list?
Before we get to that, we'll be back after a break. I'm thankful for Giannis's mid-range jumper improvement. It is just a beautiful thing to witness. He's making nearly 50% of his mid-range jumpers. I know it's, you know, everybody knows at this point he worked with Drew Hanlon this offseason. We know Drew Hanlon went to Greece during the Olympics. That's already been reported on in Milwaukee. But the improvement is happening fast. The shot looks good. It looks smooth. Giannis looks incredibly confident. It has never looked better. And he's getting to that spot on the elbows. And I think over the course of time, if he sustains this, how do you stop this guy? How do you stop him if he has that as a weapon, just to pull up and hit 50% of his mid-range jumpers? And if you do need to at least respect that, what does it do for him as a playmaker, as a passer, getting into the paint? What happens if this improvement translates to the free throw line? What if he eventually ticks over 70% again from the line? What if he gets into a career high from the free throw line? What if he becomes a guy that you can't even feel okay about fouling? What does that do for the Milwaukee Bucks and Giannis when we are already seeing this team turning around this year, getting Chris Middleton back? Looks like they're back on track. I had Giannis' third team All-NBA, and the Bucks on X went at me for it. Not bad for third team All-NBA. Hey, he needed to pick it up on defense. That's why I had him third team.
Did they do that?
They did do that, yes. they said not bad for third team all NBA. It's like, dude, it was a 1 month award. Your team is below 500. He himself needs to improve on defense as well and get back to the level that we know he can get to. I know he's been dominant on offense. He'll get there. He's going to end up probably top five MVP voting. That's probably the where things are going to go eventually this season. Chill out, Bucks fans. Relax.
Like, they don't, I mean, they don't want people to be responding like, yeah, you guys are like three games under 500. Yeah, like it's an amazing thing that he's third team all NBA. You know, most players on below 500 teams don't make it, you know?
Yes.
So, whoops. Like, that was one of those moments where you're like, ah, maybe not tweet that out. But you know what? You should get a check. Like, you should get a cut of whatever Giannis wins this year because you turned it around. You lit the fire under his ass.
I mean, you know what the funny thing is, Tom? I did not think that was going to make people mad. Like, you always get people saying, this is clickbait. You did this for the clicks. It's like, no. I did not think Giannis being on my third team was going to be the thing that was going to make people mad. It was Steph being fifth on my MVP ballot, like we talked about last week. I thought that's what was going to make people mad. But I was wrong. Sometimes you think that those things, and then you publish, and people are mad about something you didn't expect. But hey, that's the nature of award voting. But I am thankful for Giannis. I'm loving seeing his improvement. It makes me very happy. And I look forward to seeing where this progression goes because I don't think he's done getting better. I don't. I think this improvement will continue in a lot of different ways.
I hope it does because maybe after this runs, he'll go on a free throw rampage mm-hmm. and start hitting his free throws, or he starts hitting his threes, because those are near career low levels, is his three pointers and yes. his free throws. So like, I want this mid-range stuff to translate to the other areas of the floor, because like, it is good that he has that mid-range in his pocket now, in his bag, because like you described, imagine if he's running downhill and you wall up the paint, he can stop and hit an open mid-range jumper now. And if that's going to be at 50% or 60% knockdown percentage, then that's going to open up so much more for his game. You're going to have to guard up him closer, and he's going to find ways to get into the basket if you have to guard him so close to prevent that mid-range. Defenses are going to want to force him to take those mid-ranges. So it's almost like you don't want him to get too far in love with that mid-range, but he's not doing it too much now. He's still getting to the rack and still unbelievable. But I do think that it opens up a lot more for his game. What you want to do as an offensive player is create really tough decisions for the defense. The more decisions that you create for a defense, the more you make them think. This is something that Brandon Payne, who trained Stephen Curry, this is what he's been doing with Stephen Curry his whole career. Is like, I want to create as many opportunities for the defense to think. Because as soon as you make a defender think and not based on instinct or go outside of the playbook going into the game, they're dead. And so if Giannis can have another weapon in his bag that makes you think, oh, wait, he's a 60% mid-range shooter. I got to guard him out there. That can translate into easier buckets in other ways.
Absolutely. What's next on your list, Tom?
Jared Allen. I just love the guy. There's something about Jared Allen that makes me long for the days when I was a kid and I get a basketball card and I'd look at him like they had a guy who looked like that in the NBA with that hair and he was an all-star. And then you look at the basketball card and it says his favorite movie is the Lego movie and he builds computers in his spare time. Like this, he's a cartoon character at some point, you know, where it's just, he's awesome. He's a nerd. You can point to him and just be like, he's just like us, where he's like, he's basketball is an amazing thing that he does, but it's not what defines him. And it's also, he has other interests beyond basketball that makes him, I think, an icon in not just the basketball community, but for other tech-based communities or Comic-Con or whatever it is that he's into. This guy builds computers like for fun. He screams so loud when he gets a defensive 3-second call because the team loves when you get defensive 3 calls because that means that you're anchoring the paint and you're staying in the paint and you're tempting the referees to call that damn 3-second violation. And if they do it, that means you've been doing your job, which is to own that paint, own that area on the floor. There's this quirkiness to Jared Allen that I just love about him beyond the basketball stuff. He's great at basketball, the defense, the finishing above the rim, the high IQ plays for a team that ran out to an amazing start. But I think just everything, I just love everything about Jared Allen.
Have you ever interviewed him? Talked to him?
I haven't gotten the opportunity, Kevin, and it might have to go number one on my Christmas list.
Yeah, he's a super sweet guy. Very nice, very kind, great interview. I interviewed him years back when he was with the Nets. I forget. The funny thing is with that Nets story, like the whole, this is pre-Kyrie, pre-KD, and the whole thing about it was like no skipping steps. That was Sean Marks' belief. Building the Nets, like, don't skip steps. And then they end up going to get Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant. And it blew it all up.
Steps were skipped.
And DeAndre Jordan takes Jared Allen's job because the Stars didn't want to rely on the young guy. What a mistake.
Yeah. DJ has that power over coaches and front offices. I mean, he has this locker room presence and this transformative just energy about him that I get it. He's a fun guy.
Great energy. How cool is it, though, that now Jared Allen ends up reunited with Kenny Atkinson, who was the coach of those Nets teams at the time. And now they're back together again. And Jared Allen, like, not taking anything away from what he's done in recent years, he's been excellent in recent years for Cleveland. But I feel like we are seeing the best version overall of Jared Allen so far this year under Kenny Atkinson.
Yeah, I mean, you could do a secondary, I'm thankful for the Cavs for getting out to a 15-0 start and having this, this arch enemy for the Boston Celtics, a storyline that it isn't just going to be a cakewalk to the NBA Finals like it was last year. We are going to have the Cleveland Cavaliers. They're here. And Jared Allen's here, and he is going to build some computers and watch a lot of Lego movies in his spare time. So I'm very appreciative of Jared Allen. What's next on your list?
This is the last one on my list. I'm thankful for the best nickname in the NBA right now. Area 51, Stephon Castle, number 5, and Victor Wembanyama, number 1. These two are going to be terrorizing teams for a decade plus. Castle's already good, dude. He's good. He's great. Did you see his game the other night? What he did against the Warriors, chasing around Steph Curry all game long, sticking to him like glue, off ball. Nobody can stop Steph. But Castle did the best job that I think you can possibly do. And then there was this sequence that I posted on X where he hit a layup to tie the game. And then he had amazing rim protection at the rim. And then he hit a trail three to give the Spurs the lead. And I'm like, this dude's just a rookie. And in his first month of the year, and he's chasing around Steph, playing 30 plus minutes, making clutch baskets, making clutch defensive plays on back-to-back-to-back plays late in the fourth quarter. How is this dude just a rookie? And then you remember, oh, wait a minute. He just won a national championship with UConn doing the same thing. This is just who he is. And the Spurs now have that guy with Victor Wembanyama, the best young player we've had since LeBron James, who's eventually going to be the best player in the NBA. I think the Spurs hit another home run in the draft, so I'm thankful for Area 51, Castle and Wemby, and especially thankful for Castle, him landing with the Spurs.
That's a great nickname. I just got to say it.
That's
fantastic.
It's great, isn't it? I know. I think it was created by somebody on X. It was like a fan of the Spurs who just came up with it.
That makes sense. I mean, crowdsourcing NBA nicknames hasn't befallen us before, so I'm sure we'll get another one. DC, Kling Kong, also Stephon's teammate at UConn. One. Great nickname. Are we in the golden era of nicknames in the NBA? I feel like we're having a moment there.
Credit, I believe this is correct. Credit for Area 51 to @RealPJHoops. I believe that is the origin of the Area 51 nickname. That is my understanding.
So a very milquetoast username, but the guy comes up with a great nickname. I mean, he doesn't use his brain power to create his own nickname. Real PJ no. Hoops, was it?
@RealPJHoops. Yes.
Hey, shouts to Real PJ Hoops on that one. Here's my last, well, one thing on, is it Stefan Cass? I've heard it both ways and now I'm inside my own head. I am now insecure about whether it's Stefan or Stefan.
People have begun to call him Steph Castle. So
that's, you know what?
There it is, Steph Castle.
You're making a business decision. That is the business decision of names, is I'm just not even going to go there. I'm going to go with Steph Castle. Steph Castle, another thing with Steph Castle, Kev, is the idea of the dunk. It kind of wraps back to the dunk score, is I think we're going to get who are the best D-cell players in the NBA. His D-cell is unreal. Anthony Edwards, James Harden, Luka Doncic, these guys have the best breaks in the NBA. It's the ability to stop on a dime. Steph Castle's got that. That's yes. Right. Steph Castle. Steph Castle has that D-cell, which is going to have to be in the bag for anyone who wants to make an elite level as a scorer. You have to be able to stop in the paint. And it might seem like a travel, but it's not. By the book, these D-cells are legal plays, and it gets so much daylight at the rim. So Steph Castle already has that, and he's a rookie. And it makes sense, given that he's, you know, coming from the Dan Hurley double championship at UConn, playing with Kling Kong, who's been outstanding for the Blazers. Last one here. I'm thankful for the NBA Cup.
Yeah, let's go. Yes.
This thing gets so much hate and derision for, I don't understand why. Like, I don't understand. The idea that this hasn't increased the level of interest in the 82-game season. The players care about it. Last year was a big success. And I get it. The courts are weird. I understand that people visually might not like this, and they associate the weird courts with the idea of the NBA Cup. The season is so long as it is. 82 games is way too much. I think that they should cut down the number of games in the season, make games matter more. But what they did was they made games matter a little bit more with the NBA Cup. They created a venue in Vegas to make it feel different. I think the NBA Cup is one of the best things the NBA has done in recent years. I was a fan of the play-in game. And people didn't like the play-in tournament, the play-in games to get into the playoffs, and then it was awesome. People didn't like the idea of the NBA Cup, and I think even now, I still like it a lot. I think it's a great addition to the schedule, but I think in time, we will look back at the same way with the NBA Cup as the play-in tournament. This is great. This is great for the league because 82 games of regular season where we know who the good teams are, like 10 games in, 20 games in, we already know who's going to be at the end of the regular season. The NBA Cup is a great addition to the NBA calendar, and I'm very thankful for it, and I can't wait for it to get started.
I'm very excited as well, Tom. I think they should make it even bigger in the years to come. When we expand to 32 teams, I don't see why not have single elimination all 32 teams. Why not? Why not
Let's
just make it even bigger?
Let's go. There's no, I mean, I get it. The Warriors won 73 games and the Bulls, you know, 72 wins, but there's no like cherished records over the regular season. Like, I just feel like we gotta make the 82 game schedule more exciting. Have people locked in November and December and January and a 32 team single elimination tournament. Let's go.
And tell me this, Tom, right? There will be a team someday, maybe it'll happen this year, that ends up winning the NBA Cup. They end the regular season with the best record in the NBA, and then they win the finals. And that'll be the NBA team version of like the Triple Crown. The team that wins the NBA Cup gets the best record and wins the finals. And then it'll be 4 years before that happens again, or 10 years, or 20 years. Or wait a minute, maybe someday it'll be 25 years since a team won the cup and had the best record and won the finals. A proof of continued dominance from October all the way through June. And it might be many years before that happens again, whenever it happens, if it happens. But to me, I think there is something to that when you talk about, oh, this doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything. But yeah, over the course of time, there will be meaning to the NBA Cup and what it means to have that dominance over the course of the entire year. So I believe that will happen someday. And maybe it'll be this year. Maybe it'll be Cleveland. Maybe Cleveland will do it. Who knows?
So Kev, I'm guilty of this. Every week at TomTheFinder.com, I do my Tom's Title Tiers. And I'm just as guilty as everybody else in placing so much weight around the idea of winning a title, right? It does feel weird to be talking about title contenders when the championship is 7 months away. You know, I wish there was not this fascination and revolving around the championship and big titles or big rings, count the rings, right? That to me is probably in the long run a little unhealthy for the sport, is that whether you win one or you don't matters so much in the league. And it's not just from the nerds, it's not just from the media, it's from the players, they talk about it. It's from, I want to jump from team to team to raise my chances of winning an NBA championship, or a coach, you know, wants to win the big one so that they can become a Hall of Famer or have a pay rate, whatever it is that we place on these coaches that win a championship. Eric Spoelstra isn't considered a great coach until he wins a championship. And now he's, you know, considered rightfully among the top 10 coaches in NBA history. But I do think the NBA Cup is a way to flatten the overemphasis or the big title in the NBA, as I'll call it, because it does feel like it just has more power over the conversation than it should. We should introduce other things that people care about and that people can point to and say, hey, this is a great team. And even if they don't win the title, they were great for X, Y, and Z, and have, you know, other things that we can hang banners about. Not, we don't need to make everything why am I blanking out on the term?
Participation trophy? Is that what you're going?
Yes, thank you. Yes, the participation trophy of the participation trophyification of, you know, society. I'm not saying we need to give out participation trophies for everything. I'm just saying we shouldn't have everything be about whether a guy or a team or a coach won a title or not.
I'm with you. I agree, Tom. And I like the NBA experimenting, the new All-Star game tournament and all that as well. Play-in tournament, people were speculated, you know, oh, this is going to stink. It's a gimmick. Oh, now everybody loves it. I think an NBA Cup over time, people will grow to love that. I think the All-Star Game tournament could potentially be a hit as well, as long as the players try. That's the big question there. If the players buy in, it's good. If the players buy in and put in effort, that's when it's good. Tom, appreciate you joining me on today's episode. Hope you had a happy Thanksgiving, man.
Yeah, thank you. You too. A lot to be thankful for, and especially thankful for the audience out there. Thank you for listening and subscribing, rating, and reviewing. Appreciate it.
Go listen to Tom Haberstroh over at The Big Number every Thursday. His show publishes. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Please subscribe if you haven't done so already. Thanks to Joe for producing. Thanks to you. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Have a good weekend.